We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
The Zone Coverage Podcast Network.
Hey, yeah. I feel like Kobe in the fourth quarter.
This is the Dane Moore NBA podcast brought to you by ZoneCoverage.com, Zone Coverage Podcast Network. It is Monday, October 14th. And I'm joined in studio today by John Krasinski of The Athletic. We were just wined and dined by the Minnesota Timberwolves concession stand renovation. I don't know, what's the proper terminology there?
I think they're just elevating the food and beverage experience at Target Center, right?
Hey, you know what? Like, we were joking about the classic kind of cliches of like media getting the free meals all the time before this, but the food was legit.
Really good.
Like, actually, I mean, and I remember back in the day, like coming to Timberwolves games, like as a kid, and it was
garbage.
Garbage. Yes. Like a hot dog wasn't even safe.
No.
There was no options. So regardless of what transpires on the floor this year,
the food will be good.
The food.
We can report that news right now for sure.
Exactly. No, I wanted to have John on the show here sometime before the season started just to, you know, kind of plant our flag and where we think things are going into what is going to be a sea change of sorts of seasons here. But the story you wrote at The Athletic this past week highlighted just a kind of character, I think, in this new shift that I think is very interesting in Sachin Gupta, who maybe a more casual fan would only know as the trade machine guy. Mm-hmm. And I think you did a good job of kind of peeling back who Sachin is, who is in my interactions has been an awesome guy, and I think you captured that and from quotes from all those guys. But if this is going to work, like big picture, everything, if this is going to work, it's going to require Sachin kind of coming through and making this happen, obviously in tandem with the rest of the front office. But when you are in such a position that Gerson Rosas inherited in a suboptimal market, difficult books, like, as he said, you got to work differently, and Sachin seems to be the guy who can bring that.
Yeah, he's I think within the league, people know him as this deal maker, the human trade machine, really, right. And just the way that he thinks about things and comes up with different creative ideas to exploit the margins. And this is a team right now that needs to exploit the margins because there's just not much room to work. Otherwise, with Teague and with Wiggins and Towns and like all of these contracts that they have, Gorgie, that they have on the books, it's clogged. But
it's even more than like, and you hit this right at the beginning of the story where you were like, it's that, sure, but all of those problems are temporary,
right?
Like, they're going to have the chance to make their own free agent decisions in the future. But at the beginning, you said it's how do you build a sustainable model of success in a market that spends 5 months a year, mm-hmm. you know, crushed by ice and snow, and it hasn't been a franchise that has traditionally kind of had any sort of success here. Quite the opposite. So that is really what. That increases the margins is kind of the way I take it.
Yeah, I think so. And the other thing that like he brings to the table, and I think some of the people both in Houston and Philly when he was there, like some of if there was a criticism of both of them in the Morey regime, the Hinkie regime, it's like they look at players as assets. They don't factor in the emotional part of the game, the chemistry and those things. And Sachin told me, and I don't think it made the story, but Sachin said, look, I think he did at one point, but he said there is room in a front office that you need sort of a dispassionate, objective thinker. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I get the impression that Sachin is going to be one of those people who says, when they say, he's going to say, why can't we do this? Yeah. And someone, you know, maybe a hardcore basketball guy or a coach or something might say, oh, we can't do that. I mean, that you think about the emotion, and he's going to bring different ideas to the table that are more coldly rational, as he puts it. And that is going to be what it takes to kind of reshape things and to not let those outside forces like weather or the past failures kind of get in their way, I think.
Right.
And so he needs, you know, he's going to be looking at it from a totally different perspective of, well, no, this is what we have to do to make it work.
It is so funny because he is not a coldly rational like person. He's
super
warm.
Very nice.
Yeah. But
yeah.
But it's just kind of that type of thinking in any sort of, you know, business. You need to, it's the maximization.
Yeah.
And it's figuring out, all right, this is not only the hole we're in, this is how we get out of it. And like charting out a million different paths for that, because I think the conversations I've had with those guys, I don't think they think they have any sort of brilliant blueprint.
There's
that
no pixie dust.
No, yeah. It's about compounding hundreds of good decisions on top of each other that lead to something that's bigger. And I think if we look around at the other teams who have made the leaps and come out of nowhere into being something special, I think when you revisionist history kind of go back, you're like, yeah, they made hundreds of good, the majority of the decisions were good.
Yeah.
All the way up and down. And that's that coldly rational line of thinking of like, hey, that should be our goal. That seems to not only be emblematic of Sachin, but Gerson and everybody else in the organization.
Well, yeah. And I think like it's also key. Clearly what Gerson has done in terms of assembling his front office is varied perspectives. So maybe Sachin is more of the coldly rational one, where Ryan Saunders is clearly more of the human side, like the touchy feely type. Then you have, you know, Gianluca Pescucci, who's more of a scout. Mm-hmm. Then you have Joe Branch, who's an agent. Like, they have all of these different perspectives. Robbie Sicca is a medical doctor. Mm-hmm. I think that what he's tried to do is get so many different perspectives in the room, and so they can kind of all fire their ideas at each other, and they all look at each issue from a different angle. Yeah. And so I think that gives them a better chance of arriving at a path forward and a choice or a decision with a positive outcome over getting a bunch of people who are like the same in the room. And
which has been and you can speak this better than I can, that has been such a piece of the past front offices, the identity of the other groups, whether I mean Tibbs and before him, and even for all the great things that Flip did for him, it was groupthink in a way, right?
Correct.
Similar minded, similar background people who obviously they did find some success in that, but in a league that's getting only more competitive, in every team's got guys who are now picking at the margins to figure it out. It's a diversity of perspectives. And I think, you know, if you administer truth serum to these guys, would they say, I'm certain this is going to work?
Yeah.
No. Yeah. I don't think, but I think what they're certain of is they are on a path that is leading to something that could work.
Right.
And that has not been Timberwolves basketball for the past 15 years.
Right. All the way back to McHale. I mean, right. McHale was surrounded by, a lot of his friends. And I think there were certainly debates and they were certainly back and forths. But they all had roots in the same tree.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of, hey, what do you think of this? Yeah, I agree with that. Because they looked at the game from the same perspective.
Sure.
David Kahn had all of his issues, but he was kind of surrounded by a very not like-minded, because no one is like-minded to David Kahn, but just backgrounds that are the same.
Yeah.
And Flip and Milt Newton were very much in lockstep on a lot of things. Tibbs, Layden, Brian Pauga, mm-hmm. all the same people. And so there wasn't a whole lot of vigorous debate, I don't think. And so I think like the idea with this setup is they want to spur debate and they want to have conversations, and that's where they think the best alternatives will come up around. I mean, Will Weaver in the Sachin story told me that, Sam Hinkie would have him and Will Weaver and Sachin. And
Will was a scout, right?
He did some assistant coaching, then he did some personnel work as well. And then they had Vince Rosman, who's another scout, and they all went in the room and they would just go around the table. Hey, what do you think we should do? What do you think we should do? And then Sachin would go at the end and everyone would say, well, yeah, obviously that's what we should do. Like, we're not going to waste our time anymore. You're going first next time, Sachin. So, but I mean, that's it. I think when you talk to people who have been with Sachin and been around, like a lot of them will say, at first people are looking at him and being like, what does this guy really bring to the table? He kind of sits in the corner and just watches things and asks questions and that's it. But the more that you spend time around him, the more you get an insight into his process of diagramming a problem and pulling at the threads to kind of simplify it as much as possible.
To me, in the conversations I've had about him, just kind of shooting the shit about random other, like outside of Timberwolves signings and stuff that happened mm-hmm. over the course of the year, it's what sticks out to me in every single time we've talked about it is he highlights the other side of this worked, but what was the other side of it? What was the negative? Why wouldn't have it worked?
Mm-hmm.
And I just think that's so much more encompassing. And that's probably just a smart way to think about decision-making in life mm-hmm. is to, take a step back and acknowledge both sides of it. And it's in the beginning of your story, the rodeo.
Yeah.
So yeah, give that story. So he's back. This is like 2006. He's probably like 20 something.
Yes. So it's his first year in Houston, and the Houston Rodeo is like the big thing that happens in Houston. It's their signature event. It's like Mardi Gras, whatever you want to call it. There's 2.5 million people that go to this thing over 20 days. And so a lot of the Rockets people will go because they all come from all over the country and maybe even all over the world to work for Daryl Morey and Sam Hinkie and all those. And
because Gerson, Daryl, Hinkie, and Sachin were all on the staff back then. I mean, this is the very beginning of the nascent days of the Morey era.
Yep. And so they all come from all over the place. And so one way to sort of just imbibe yourself in the culture and kind of get a feel for the region is to go to this thing and just experience it and see what the people mm-hmm. like and all that. And there's big concerts and all these events and things that kind of gear people up. Well, Sachin went to kind of see what all the fuss was about. And one of the signature events of the rodeo is called this calf scramble, where these teenage kids have to chase these calves around an arena floor, and they put a lasso around their heads and then pull them back into this ring, like this 50 by 50 ring. And if you pull the calf into the ring, you get like a gift certificate to buy a calf, essentially. So it's a competitive thing. And, if you just Google calf scramble and watch some of the video, I mean, there's these kids that are just pulling on these 200-pound calves and they're dug in and they're not going anywhere. Like they don't want to move. You have to like lift them up and wrestle them in. And it's this big process. And, so Sachin goes to the calf scramble and comes back to the Rockets office the next day. And there's people in there. And, hey, Sachin, how'd you you know, what'd you think about the event? And he's like, yeah, I went to the calf scramble, and boy, they're, you know, really interesting. You know, they're fighting these calves, and the guys are laughing. Oh yeah, isn't that crazy? You know, kind of thing. Like, pretty funny, isn't it? And he's like, you know, I just thought that, why didn't they go pull them in the opposite direction that they're supposed to go, and then the calves are going to pull against that and going to walk themselves right into the ring, and there's no problem. And like, the room fell silent, and you know, these are all these big thinkers. Right. This is Daryl Morey and Sam Hinkie, and you know, all these brain wizards of the NBA, and they're kind of like, God damn, why didn't I think of that? Like, yeah, that's a good idea, Sachin. And so, yeah, that has nothing to do with basketball, but everything to do with how he thinks, right, and like how he attacks problems and really tries to just get to the very heart, the base level conflict that is in front of them, and make it feel like they've run into this problem a million times before, and that's how they solve it. So, that's just, you know, that's the way that he goes about looking at the world and
thinking.
And it, for like the really smart people like Ben Falk from Cleaning the Glass, and you had, like, these guys, when you talk to them, they're like, it's clearly they're operating on another plane from where I'm at. But to hear them kind of speak in this, you know, reverent tones toward Sachin, it really tells you, you know, what they think of him as just a thinker and a person and a human being.
Right. And I, honestly, the human being part has really stood out to me in that sort of way. And then, you know, you just kind of go through the history of, like, well, what Houston did in his time that I was there, and the progression that he made, that whole organization. I mean, credit to Gerson and Daryl and all those guys too. But I mean, not only does that seem logical, but it worked.
Yeah, and like, what those guys all say too is like, and they offer this up, I didn't have to go fishing for it. It's like, no, Sachin was the one. Like, right, the Brent Johnson, the scout, says, you know, anything, like, whatever problem we had, we just figured Sachin will fix it. Like, and like, Sachin, you know, was kind of the spearhead of the Harden trade. Yeah. Sachin did the Sacramento trade in Philly that got them rolling towards all those picks and things. I mean, like, he is at the very genesis of so many of the real kind of difference-making moves that both of those organizations made to kind of get rolling.
Well, right, and it's like, it seems the Philadelphia one tends to have like more of a negative connotation, kind of for some of the reasons you mentioned with the, you know, it didn't play as well in the media at the time there and all that. But as now we're pretty far removed from the quote-unquote process. You look at,
looks pretty good.
It looks pretty damn good. Like, and it's, I think that's just the process is on steroids. The idea of trying to find a million different margin things and putting them all in one pile and seeing what that grows into. Mm-hmm. And I think with this, and I mean, I think you agree with me, it's not going to be like that here. Obviously, they're not going to tank.
They're not tearing it down and tanking. Yeah,
but it's not even going to be like immediate. Like,
right,
like, in Philadelphia, they tried to make as many decisions as they could because they figured every single decision they'd be 51% right.
Yes.
You know? And I think they made too many decisions. Mm-hmm. It just led to too much churn. It led to the negative stuff of it. So the vibe I get, at least, is they still want to make that pile, but they're okay with taking a little bit more time and, you know, trying to grow a little bit more linearly.
Right.
Whereas Philly was like, we're going to go real flat and then we're going to spike. That was the idea.
Yeah, and there's two parts of that. One is the actual, like, the very base idea of the process was sound.
Yeah.
Let's get bad, stockpile assets, get as many bites of the apple as we can.
Sure.
And we think it'll eventually turn into a really good thing. And they are being validated by that right now. But in the realistic, in the real world, it is too much to ask of an ownership group, of a fan base, of a team to go that bad for three seasons. Like, mm-hmm. that's too long to do it. You can do it for one, maybe two, but if you have to go a third one.
And it just wasn't even effectively spun either.
Right. And that's what Sachin said to me, and I thought was interesting in the piece as well, is that he kind of is looking back on his time there and saying, you know, I'm very proud of some of the things that we did, and I thought we had a good process and we had good ideas. But I do think that we needed to be a little better at the media side, the relationship building side, outside of the basketball operations and team, because it was like the Hinkie regime was very closed off. I mean, it was like Tibbs in that way, where you couldn't get in. They were, you know, hard on agents. They were hard on a lot of people around the league. And so the encouraging thing for me is that Sachin had that reflection as he's looking back on that and thinking about maybe how things have to be a little different here. Now, clearly here, Gerson understands there needs to be more outreach. There needs to be more transparency with, you know, fans and media and things like that. And that will help smooth over some of the tougher times, or at least let people understand.
Yeah, things the a information, bit like like what are you doing? I think it took in Philly. It took this, and it kind of worked actually, where the diehard Sixers fans, and then you know you think about the Rice to Ricky Sanchez podcast, and like some of those guys, they kind of like explained it.
Right,
they explained it, and they got people behind it, and it actually made people, ironically, fall in love with Robert Covington, Dario Saric. I mean, we saw all of them fly out to a game here in Minneapolis last season. And it's just, it's funny. It's just like these essentially fans, maybe bloggers, whatever, who explained it to you. But it was like from the front office itself, like Hinkie spoke like a stupendously few amount of times over his entire tenure there, and just kind of, in ways, it was Tibbs-ish.
Yes, absolutely it was.
Right? Like it was, okay, you're saying things, but I don't know what you're really saying here. Mm-hmm. And I don't think, and Tibbs wasn't this way either. Like it wasn't curt or anything like that. But in particularly today, when I think we have so much more connection to teams and what all the cliches, social media, all this and that, like people are more informed. And if you don't inform them what is actually going on, it's the whole painting where if you only see the one quarter of it, you're going to paint it with the rest of the blank canvas with what's ever in your head.
Right.
And if you're cynical, you're going to paint a bad picture. Right. Mm-hmm. And that's totally what happened in Philly there with them. And it caused it. So they had to cut ties because they were losing the fan base. And ironically, with Tibbs, that's what happened too.
Mm-hmm.
At some point we'll do this whole referendum on the whole Tibbs era. And when you do look back at it, there are positives.
Sure.
Like actually a lot, and logical, like logical moves. And even, I mean, the biggest one I say all the time is last year, the team was kind of good. Mm-hmm. Like post Jimmy until Tibbs got fired.
Yeah.
Obviously I get why they fired, but Tibbs was bad at leading the organization. He wasn't a bad basketball coach necessarily.
Right. Yeah, that's 100%. I mean, there was definitely just this penchant or this desire to say, hey, everyone else, don't worry about it. Like, just, I got this. I have it all under control. You don't have to ask questions about it. This is all going to work out. Just watch it happen. And it was with same with Hinkie as well. Like, hey, this is a very smart plan that we're on. This is going to work out. We don't have to justify it publicly, but these are public entities and they require the fan base to support them, or else
it's an entertainment business.
Yeah. Or else you're out of a job. And
I can imagine that would be maddening though. Like Tibbs. When we're sitting there, you know, I thought about that all the time, and I'm sitting there and I'm trying to ask a basketball question about what didn't work. Mm-hmm. And he's got to be thinking in his head, who the hell is this guy?
Right.
Like, why do I know? And he does. He knows exponentially more about basketball than I do. And what I don't think he got was it was just important to share what his knowledge was.
Right.
Because he had the knowledge. And same thing with Hinkie. And to do that, and that's what I'm encouraged with in this new group, whether it be Ryan, whether it be I think that this season there's going to be plenty of things that are going to be difficult and hard. But if a fan wants to connect to the 2019-20 Minnesota Timberwolves, it's going to be easy to do because I think you're going to see them put themselves out there and already Timberwolves.com, all that, what they're doing, the track, the pack stuff, all that. I mean, you're, it's well done, and you are learning who they actually are. And sure, you got to maybe take some of it with a grain of salt. They're only accentuating the positive.
Right.
But you're informed.
Yes.
You're going to be so much more informed this year because of that. And you, in my opinion, you absolutely need that where we are in today's media entertainment landscape.
Yeah, no doubt. And I think one of the mistakes that some people make in those positions is when you or I ask questions, when fans ask questions, they say, they take it as we are sort of calling them idiots and why are you, you know, we know more than you, why don't you do it this way? But when what we're really saying is explain it to us. Like, I am asking you this question because I want to know the answer and I want to see what it is through your eyes. Now, like, I just, let's just take the Tyus Jones example for right now. Like, when they'd made the decision not to match on him, it was easy to get a hold of people to, hey, just explain why you did this. Mm-hmm. And when you have that perspective, then it just makes things a lot easier to, it makes it a lot easier for us to humanize you as a person.
Sure.
And understand that, okay, this is what they are thinking. This makes sense in that. I may not just always agree with every decision you make, but I at least see where you're coming from.
I see the logic in your argument.
Exactly. With Hinkie, he was so far removed, he took on this persona of a robot, like this cold, soulless thing. Mm-hmm. And so that made it a lot easier for the public at large or to turn on him.
Right.
Same with Tibbs. Like, he was so unwilling to explain his side of the Jimmy situation, to do all of these things, that it made it easy for people to be like, man, this guy isn't even like a human being, so I'm not going to feel bad about...
he's not treating me like I'm a human being.
Exactly.
So it's human interaction.
Yeah.
Like, and it is a bummer, because I think if Tibbs, you know, whatever, let's rewind 3 years, and you put someone alongside of him who, like, balances that out.
Right.
Like, it might be a totally different story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but the only caveat to that is that Tibbs would have to be okay with ceding some sort of control. And that's what he didn't. Because, like, what I've always said about Tibbs, and I'll continue to say this, he is not a bad guy. He's not this, like, you know, overbearing ogre that you see on the court, like the MFing refs and stuff.
With us, never.
No,
Literally never did he, was there a question where I felt he snapped at any of us.
No, and never. He met my kids. He couldn't have been nicer to my wife when I brought them to the Target shopping thing. And like, when you get him away from the court and out of the pressure cooker, like, you can have a conversation with him. Mm-hmm. You know, I tell a story about the Vegas Summer League thing, but like, I mean, he's a guy that you can just chill out with and talk basketball, and it's fun.
Mm-hmm.
In the season, when things were really tight, you could tell he was annoyed sometimes, but never took it out personally on anyone. Never like went behind anyone's back or anything like that. So it's not for me like a personal issue at all where he was this. You know, I always say he's not the prison warden from Shawshank. Like, he's not that guy.
No.
But he just did not have a good handle on the public side of the operation. And same with Sam Hinkie, same way. When your title has president in it, it's a political office.
Yes.
Like, you have to be able to shake hands and kiss babies sometimes, even if you want to hold your nose while doing it. And if you don't want to do that, then you got to recognize that and say, hey, I'm the coach. Let's put someone up there that's going to be that guy or that woman and be that, you know, the mover and the shaker. And I'm just going to do my job over here.
Right.
That would have been okay. But he wanted all that control. And I think, you know, that was ultimately a big part of the downfall.
It's funny. The only two coaches I've ever covered are Tibbs and now Ryan. And it was always so odd to me. So, you know, my first time doing it, and we do the interview with Tibbs, and he's fairly, you know, the media availability, he's fairly robotic in his answers. You don't really get anything. And then particularly it's like a Saturday afternoon practice, like we'll turn off the cameras, turn off the recorders, and he'll talk to us for, you know, 5, 10, 15 minutes. And it was informative. Mm-hmm. And I would learn what was actually going on there. But it was so different than what his on-camera persona was. And what I've noticed now with Ryan, I mean, there's always an element of, you know, the cameras are on, I'm going to be a little bit different.
Sure.
But how I talk to Ryan and how I see you talk to Ryan when we're just asking him questions in a media scrum is not that polarizing to how we'll just talk to him if we're walking down the hallway. Normal communication. And I think there's value in that. I think that's not obviously for us, it's good, but I think for, in theory, right? Like you are the microphone from Ryan or Tibbs out into the fan base or the camera is. And again, I just in today's world, you gotta handle that. And that is just as much as part of the equation. I don't know if it's just as much. It's certainly part of the equation, just as much as X's and O's are, just as much as the salary cap is, just as much as scouting is, like, because it's not all about basketball.
Mm-hmm.
We can make it a lot about basketball, but it's an entertainment business. We were just at a lunch that is a very important part of the Timberwolves organization because they're trying to make a fan experience because they are a business to do it. And I don't know, maybe that bothers some people and they would just like the basketball. But we're talking about a company that's worth over $1 billion probably.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, one of the main objectives that you should have in that position is to make yourself and your players and your organization as three-dimensional as possible. Mm-hmm. So the vast majority of people who follow the Timberwolves see them as two-dimensional on a screen.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a lot easier to judge, to criticize, to give up on a two-dimensional figure. But if there is that extra dimension to it where you see the human element of it, where you can get on some sort of level of understanding with the people in those positions of power, it is a lot easier for the fan to say, all right, I'm going to give this person the benefit of the doubt a little bit longer. I mean, eventually, if you lose enough, it doesn't matter. You could be the greatest human being of all time, and you're still going to get fired.
Yeah.
But it gives you a little bit more rope because you need it to get through the tough times. And especially right now, Gerson and Ryan and Sachin are going to need rope early on because it's going to be
a process.
There's going to be bumps in the road. We're seeing it in the preseason. I think we're going to see it in the regular season. There's going to be points where you're like, man, this is not looking good. Or, man, they can't hit the broadside of the barn and they've lost four in a row.
Right.
And without total mutiny, like that's the way you do it is by getting people to relate to you.
It is funny. We're, going off about how I feel like, getting all this information and they're helping to make us understand. Yet now, what are we? We're three preseason games in and I'm struggling to understand it all. Because now it is basketball, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like they've been telling us all these things that they want to do and these stylistic things, this and that, and it's now we're actually seeing the game be played, and it is, I think for me it's just so jarring.
Yeah,
it's so jarringly different, not in a good or bad way. I don't know if it's gonna work, but I mean, I actually think they might lead the league in pace. I think they might actually be the fastest team in the league.
Yeah.
Compared to last year, Jamal Crawford 2 years ago, just
Derrick Rose.
Right.
Jimmy.
What my excitement from this season comes from is going to be able to learn. All right, now you've told me all these things. How is this now materializing on the floor? What is this blueprint? You've told me what this blueprint is. Now we're going to have some data to apply to the blueprint. And is this going to work?
Right.
Is this going to be something that does, in fact, empower Karl-Anthony Towns? Mm-hmm. And obviously that's the goal. But it's gonna be a process, and we're already kind of seeing bumps along the way there.
Yeah, I mean, look, they're shooting all the threes in the world right now in the first two games when there's actually defense being played a little bit on them.
There was not a lot of defense last night.
It was like 20%, 25% they're shooting from the floor. From three.
Yes.
Yeah, and they're turning the ball over a lot, too, because they're playing really fast, and they're trying to get it up to the floor, and they're making sloppy mistakes. And the other part of it is that there's eight new guys on the roster.
Yeah.
And so there's eight new guys on the roster. There's whatever, six new coaches. And the guys who are holdovers from last year might as well have been traded because this is a totally, totally different approach, right? So no one has any sort of thing to kind of grab onto for familiarity right now.
And neither does Ryan.
And neither does Ryan. Exactly. And so while there is like this sort of plan that they have outlaid, but
I think it's a lot of guess and check.
I think so too. There's going to be a lot of throwing the noodles at the wall and seeing what sticks. Right. And, you know, there's going to be adjustments that go through the season, and the team, the way that they're playing in February may be fairly different from the way that they're playing in October. Now, I do think there are base elements that they just feel are going to be core concepts that they really believe have to be a part of their identity.
What are those right now, would you say?
It sure looks like they want to shoot threes and not mid-range, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It looks like they want to play fast, mm-hmm. And it looks like they're trying to move the ball.
Yeah.
Where, you know, and it's not isolation. Defensively, it's a lot harder, like, for me to...
I haven't
kind of dive into. I don't know.
I like to go into that stuff, and I've watched and rewatched, and I have no opinions.
Yeah, it's
like
hard.
It's been too messy, and that might just be the preseason. I was gonna see if you had said anything about defense, because I agree. Like what I feel confident in now that I might not have before these games is that not just fast, like fastest.
Mm-hmm.
Not just we're gonna shoot more threes. We don't really care who is shooting threes. Yep. Like, if it's a good look,
mm-hmm.
if it's a good look, they, like, percentages
bombs
be damned.
Away.
Bombs away. And I wouldn't have guessed it would have been that much. And then from, I guess, a specific, like, player rotation element of it is Culver's really surprised me in the way that he's been utilized. And I don't know, maybe I didn't watch enough of him at Texas Tech and didn't give enough credit to the whole point forward thing, but I went into this blueprint thinking that's a 2-3 of the future.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever I scoffed at whenever anyone was saying, I don't know, man, maybe he's once Teague's off, maybe he's like the point guard starting next year. And I was like, no way.
Mm-hmm.
And I try not to overact to games that include playing Israel.
Right.
But like, maybe, like, honestly, maybe. And that changes a lot. That changes a lot of because, and Britt, this is what Britt has said and written a bunch of times, is he's like, all right, you took Okogie, success, good draft pick, as well as you could have with the 20th pick there, basically, who plays the same position as Andrew Wiggins. And then you picked Jared Culver, who's also a wing, essentially the same position as Andrew Wiggins. And that inherently puts pressure on the idea of maybe he's moving out.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe he still is. You know, but obviously Andrew's his own wormhole. But like, you could, if this goes well, we could be talking about a year from now where it is Jared Culver point guard. It is Josh Okogie at the two. It is Andrew Wiggins at the three, Covington at the four, Cat at the five. And that's then not as clouded on the wing as I thought it would. And that was a big question I had in looking beyond this season.
Yeah, I think he does. He really looks comfortable with the ball in his hands, more comfortable than I expected. And point guard is the hardest position to learn, right? I mean, to make that transition from college to the pro. So if you're kind of a sort of point forward, part-time point guard in college, are you going to be able to play point guard in the NBA? Like, that's, you know, that seems like to be asking a lot. But there are... he looks comfortable doing that now. And then you go back to draft night, and when they traded up, And Garland goes at five. I'm like, well, here comes Coby White. Okay, that I mean, they need a point guard. They, right. You know, they got all. This is what's got to be. And then they take Jarrett Culver, and I think
right away we were like, okay, so then they're probably trading Culver. Like that's what we thought.
Right. Yes.
Because there's so many guys. Because there's Wiggins. Because there's Okogie. Because mm-hmm. there's all this. They had wings already.
Yeah, but I think they saw much more potential for him to be a lead playmaker. Mm-hmm. And that's why they were so high on him. And that's why, you know, I think I reported that night that they had like that top tier of five guys. And then after that, DeAndre Hunter was not in that top five. And after that, it dropped off precipitously to number six on their board. And so so they saw that potential for him to be that type of a playmaking guy. And yeah, if he can be the lead ball handler, boy, that changes a lot.
Why do you think Coby White wasn't in that group?
I don't know. So
you like Coby? We've talked about it.
Yeah, I like Coby White a lot.
Again, we are the people who don't know things.
Exactly. Please, yes. Like I love Derek Williams. All right, like let's just put that out there. So I liked Coby White because he played in a system in North Carolina that really just seemed to be translate well to the NBA. He shot the ball from the perimeter. He moved the ball past it, got it up the floor quickly. Just really liked a lot of those things. I think he has good length, even though apparently he has short arms, but I think he has good size for his position. Yeah. And I just liked what I saw when I watched him in terms of a feel of the game.
Maybe like it's they don't like Darius Garland can be in theory like a Damian Lillard type point guard, you know, like a dynamic
scorer
type of way, whereas like maybe Coby White is a different archetype of point guard that could be successful, but the archetype that Rosas wants is a scorer.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And I also think that Culver from a defensive standpoint mm-hmm. probably brings a higher upside. Definitely brings a higher upside. And then also, I mean, his work ethic, like intangibles, have been validated since he's been here. They rave about
you can't have a conversation
how hard he
about,
works.
Yeah, that's
and that's when you're starting from scratch essentially, and you're kind of coming into a roster where Wiggins's work ethic is in question, where Cat needs to be like more focused that way. I think that having this like just balls to the wall worker as one of your featured pieces, they hope probably rubs off on other people. And, you know, and then, but then finally, I think what separates him from White is White is a true one.
Yeah.
Whereas maybe Culver has that position flexibility that they want. He can play some one, he can play some two or some three. Right. You can do just so many more different things with him in
certainly
different lineups.
Guard more people for
sure. Absolutely.
And if you subscribe to the flip line of thinking is your position.
You are who you can guard.
Right.
Yep. So, I mean, that it just seems like it gives them more flexibility to do all sorts of different things than Coby White does, who is just more of he is a one, and that's about what you can get out of him.
You know what I'm interested in as it pertains to Jarrett off the floor is I just think it's interesting that he spent his entire life in Lubbock, Texas.
Yeah.
You know? And then, and obviously for anybody, it's going to be a transition to come to Minnesota. Mm-hmm. But as I understand who I understand him to be from the conversations with people I've had or my interactions with him, this is going to be a kind of a culture shock.
Mm-hmm.
And not necessarily in a bad way, but just going into the locker room after the game last night, you know, and it's an NBA locker room afterwards. Yeah. And that's got to be different, really different for him. And I don't have a good or bad opinion on it, but just sitting in there and thinking about it, and it's like, I think about myself, you know, if I was 20 years old and it's like, I don't know. I grew up in Minnesota. I went to college in Minnesota. And then if you were dropped into living somewhere else with people who are all older and different than you, because he is different.
No doubt.
He is different. And that's, I don't know. It's just going to be something I'm going to constantly have in the back of my mind the whole time.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, there's going to be an adjustment period for him with that. And like the other thing that is kind of crazy about it is he's not only dropped into a new world essentially from where he has spent almost all of his time, but he is employed in a literally like killer, not literally, but like a killer be killed type situation. Like, I mean, you are going to battle every night against the elite of the elite, and they will chew you up and spit you out if there's any sort of hesitation or anything like that. So there's a lot kind of that is circling around in his head right now. He seems like a low maintenance kind of go with the flow type of a dude. But yeah, I think that can be an incredible challenge to navigate.
We were talking about the season finale of Succession before we came over here, and kind of ends with Kendall's dad saying, "You're not a killer."
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And that works in the NBA too, man.
No doubt it does.
If you want to be top dog,
yeah,
got to be a killer. And they got some good pieces in this Timberwolves locker room. Players who, I mean, Cat for sure, Jarrett, who knows? Like, but if this works, one of, if not both of, Cat and Jarrett need to prove to be killers.
For sure.
And that, I don't know how you coach that.
Yeah, that it'll be interesting because, I mean, that was really, like, toss everything else aside, I believe that both Tibbs and Jimmy did not think that either Cat or Andrew were of that ilk and had that capability.
Yeah.
And so that's why they were both down on them for most of the time that they were there. And you can, you know, Tibbs can say all he wants about, you know, saying the right things, but you could tell, like, Tibbs just didn't believe in Cat, like, the way that he believed in Jimmy and Taj and Derek and those guys. Like, he just felt that there was a certain mentality that was missing. Now, if
I think he turned in his head, I think very early on, Tibbs flipped the switch of this guy cannot be a 1A.
Correct.
And that, you know what?
Maybe he's right, maybe not.
And there is, Cat is exceptional, but that is worthy of debate. Tibbs messed up by stamping that onto him
too early.
Too early.
Yes,
because Cat is now 23. He was 21 when he came.
Right,
and that is, again, human element of all this. Kids, these guys are kids.
Mm-hmm.
These guys are kids, and you are not who you are when you are 20, 21 years old.
Correct.
There's time for that to be defined. And what that definition is, I mean, Giannis, right?
Right.
That was a question mark with Giannis way back then.
Mm-hmm.
And now we know Giannis is a killer.
For sure.
And that element of basketball and team construction and all of it, because you can't have too many killers.
Right.
Then you start cannibalizing each other, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
That might have happened. I don't even know. That might have happened last year. But this blueprint, whatever this is, they need to kind of define the different pieces on the chessboard, on the floor, with how you're going to play schematically. Mm-hmm. And then you got to find a way to make these personalities work, because the successful teams do that. Golden State, right?
Like, yep.
That worked. You defined who your killers were, and then you found your whatever you want to define Klay Thompson is.
Yes.
Like, it's different.
Right.
But that element, and in basketball, that's so cool to me, because I think you feel that in basketball more than you do in any other sport. And it's more important. Maybe it's just less people. But I also think the game makes that a thing.
Yeah, and it, you know, what Cat has always said about this is he believes that you can be a really great player and you don't have to be the brooding asshole. Like, and look, I mean, Jordan was that. Kobe was that. You know, I think that LeBron early on in his career was probably not that, and then kind of morphed more into it a little bit. But I think
I can see a Cat parallel there.
Sure. Yeah. And so, you know, Cat has this sort of goofier side to him that is different.
It's fascinating, man.
And it's really different. And so he wants to be viewed sort of as this Renaissance man. Like, he's got interests all over the globe. He's got things that, you know, that are beyond basketball with him. But he still brings it on a nightly basis on the court for the most part, except you can push and pull on his defense a little bit. But I think
when the game is going, Cat plays with grit.
Yeah.
It's when the whistle blows, and particularly if it's blown at him, that you can start questioning that stuff, because he's complaining, or you don't like how he acts behind a camera screen, whatever. I hear all that. When they're playing basketball, Cat's gritty as hell.
No doubt.
I mean, he's still young. Like that. Yeah. That's why he's been good.
Yes.
That's why he's 23. His body isn't what it can be, all that. Like, the dude can play.
Yeah. And he's, just like as consistent as there is. Like, can you remember a four-game stretch where he's not?
No.
No, it doesn't happen.
He fills it
like,
up.
It never happens. So, like he says, look, I'm doing all this and I'm actually, a record setter from a young age in terms of like the amount of points he scored and the rebound. All these things are off the charts. And so, but he's not going to be the one that looks at other people in locker rooms and say, listen, get on board with me. Like, that's not the way that he leads. So it's just a matter of, will these guys respond to the way that he kind of sets forth?
Or does it change?
In a different, maybe it will change.
I mean, I don't know. I think probably not. But I go back to I was very different when I was 23 versus when I was 26. Like, and we've seen that in the NBA too. Like,
Giannis went, the leap was in like year five, right?
Sure.
So, and now Kat's going into year five. Wig went into year five last year and it didn't happen. Mm-hmm. So some people have it and some people don't. But, a couple of things have to happen for the Wolves to get to whatever their ceiling is. Like, Kat has to take that next step, and there has to be a sort of a galvanizing of the teammates around him and a following of him. However that happens, if they just say, hey, look, we like this guy's goofy personality, we can relate to it, we're on board with it, we got your back. Or if Kat kind of changes his tone a little bit and adjusts and demands more and they respond, whatever way that it goes, that's got to happen. Covington's got to stay healthy. And Wiggins has to do at least a little something. Mm-hmm. And then, then you can look at a team and squint and maybe see a 40 win something or other. But
and you can look beyond this year.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not getting too caught in what happens this year, mostly just because it's almost impossible to make the playoffs.
Right.
When you're this amount of talent, given what the West is.
Yeah, no, this year is all about laying the foundation and having some sort of point to jump off of into next year.
And establish that point early. Establish that point early and have your Noah Vonleh, Jordan Bell's, Jake Layman's like be the tertiary pieces. And maybe they aren't the tertiary pieces of the future. We know how much rosters turn over in the league, even when guys are on multi-year deals.
No doubt.
Rosters flip.
Yep.
And in this roster, what they have now, on the next good Wolves team, probably includes very few players that are currently on this team.
Correct.
And that's just the nature. That's just the nature of all this. I do think, like, and again, we were talking about this before, it's like, I don't know where the interest level is from the fan base for this season. And maybe I'm just a nerd, biased, whatever. But I think there's this, like, three-dimensional element of it that's fascinating. Even if on the floor you're not getting a playoff team, you're starting something that could become even better than a playoff team. Like, they're trying to build something that does not have a glass ceiling. And the Tibbs model had a glass ceiling, period.
Yep.
It just did.
That concrete ceiling.
Concrete ceiling.
There's no breaking that. Yeah, but, we were talking, so the difficult thing for fans, trying to gear up for this season is that they've been kicked in the teeth so many times before.
Oh, I don't blame them, Brian.
And that also, the core figures of Kat and Wiggins have been here for a long time. So we were talking about how Atlanta, there was excitement around the Hawks last year, even though they were not that good. But it was also fresh and new with Trae Young and Herter and all those guys that it was kind of more like what it was when it was LaVine Wiggins Towns.
Sure.
And there was a lot of excitement around that group. And they didn't mind necessarily that it wasn't a team that won a lot. I think that fans this year are, if they're going to get excited, they are separating the last 12 years from this year and saying, this is all brand new. Mm-hmm. Like, I want to see what happens here with this group under these set of system with this leadership from Rosas and Saunders. This is all brand new to me, and I'm going to look at it through a lens like I'm seeing this all for the first time. And then if those people will probably, I'm going to guess, watch how this team plays, probably see the effort, the chemistry, see the just the stylistic improvements that kind of let you believe that they're not bringing a knife to a gunfight every sure. night. And you're going to say, okay, like this is intriguing. This is kind of exciting. I can't wait to see how they tailor the roster to better fit the system. But it's the ingredients are starting to come together.
The infrastructure.
To see something that in a year or two or three could be really good. Mm-hmm. But if you're a fan that says, it's the Timberwolves, they always screw things up.
Yeah.
Well, then there's not going to be any reason to tune in for sure.
He's John Krasinski of The Athletic. You can follow the work him and Britt and a whole bunch of NBA writers do there. Thanks for coming on, John. We'll be around. We'll be talking whatever happens this year a lot. Too much, probably.
We will always be around each other. That's for sure.
That's true. John drove me over here. I was joking. He's my and he drove me home last night. He's my Uber driver. So
we'll be getting a bill pretty soon.
Yeah. Thanks for coming on. You can follow John on Twitter at John Krasinski. I'm Dane Moore at Dane Moore NBA. We will be back on Thursday with another Timberwolves game that will have actually played an NBA team. So it might be
woohoo
a little bit more interesting. Indiana's on Tuesday. So check that out and stay tuned. We'll keep coming with these pods Mondays and Thursdays. And like I've been mentioning at the end of these shows, please, it does help if you do the rating and review whole thing there on iTunes. And I appreciate the reviews even more because it's cool to hear what you guys are liking and what of these guests of what are the things that you want to happen over the course here. Because, you know, if it gets lean, if it gets lean during the middle of the season, we're going to need to, I don't know, beef it up a little bit. So thank you for listening. Again, we'll be back Thursday. Till then, I'm Dane. Peace out. How I'm feeling, man, I hope it never stop, yeah. Green and hot so you can find me in the crowd, yeah, yeah. Don't let standards ever bring you down, yeah. Hope you dancing like nobody else around, yeah.